It's a wonderful opportunity if any of you belong to an organization in your own home community and wish to become involved with the Inquiring Mind Lecture Series. It's a wonderful opportunity for your community and for your organization. We do have some brochures up here called Leap into Another World if you're interested in how you might support this program. As you probably know, public spending for the humanities is threatened at the moment and can use all the friends and support that you can offer at this time. I am passing around evaluation forms. The Washington Commission for the Humanities asks that we take evaluations of the programs in their effort to improve their programming year after year. Finally, I have the opportunity of introducing for you Mr. Scott Brundage, who has had a long and varied career as a journalist, a sportscaster, an actor, and a theatrical producer. He has also spent several years in politics as an aide to State Representative Horace Bosworth, Congressman Mike McCormick, and Senator Henry S. Jackson. Since 1983, he has been closely involved with local theater in the North Central Washington area, and is currently the owner and producer of the Chelan Dinner Theater. With long-standing commitment to education, he serves on the Board of Trustees of Wenatchee Valley College. This evening, Scott's talk is called Mr. Truman, Man of Independence. And Scott is Mr. Truman, and so it is with great pleasure that I ask you to greet, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My goodness, it's, oh my, did they put the Democrats away up there? Well, I'm very pleased to see you all here this evening. I was just checking, it doesn't appear there's anything big enough up there to contain tomatoes, so I'll be all right. I am very pleased. Are there any Republicans in here? Well, now, let's try that again. Are there any Republicans in here? That's all? My goodness, we'll have a devil of a time raising any money tonight. I am pleased to be here. I know you expect a politician to come before you and say that, but well, the fact is that I am pleased to be here. I understand that most of you folks are from a Lutheran retreat, is that right? Well, there could be a problem then. I'm a Baptist, you know. I am a light-footed Baptist, though. You know what that is, don't you? It means we dance and we don't feel guilty about it. Now, I tell you, I have always, as long as I have started out on that subject, I've always felt that a person's relationship with his religion is very important. I'm a student of history. One thing I have learned about it is you can never say you know history. You can only say you're a student of it. Of course, that's about true of life when I think about it. I began studying history when my mother got me a series of books when I was a little boy, about 5 years old. And it was a whole series of books on heroes out of the history of the world. And there was even one volume that had heroines in it. But if you knew my mother, you'd wonder why there weren't more. That's where I began to learn my history, and I read the library in Independence. I didn't know what book to choose, so I just picked them all. I had to do that, you see. I had to be a student because my eyeballs are shaped odd. Well, that's not a surprise to some of you Republicans, I know. But I wanted to go to West Point, and I could have got in there, too. But they turned me down because I had these odd-shaped eyeballs. What that meant, though, as a little boy, was that I wasn't one of the regular fellas, if you know what I mean. I wasn't the kid that could play football the best, or baseball, or that kind of thing. Since I had glasses, they always made me the umpire in baseball. So I learned in a hurry how to take a ration of stuff from people, you know. But when I had to study history, one of the things that I found was the importance of religion. and how often it has messed things up in our world. And how often, by failing to follow it, we have messed things up anyway. So I believe in it very strongly. I'm not very public about it in general. I have written my own prayer. That's a private matter. I always carry it with me in my wallet. And every now and then, I like to look at it. And basically, when I pray, it's simply to ask the good Lord to give me a little common sense. Common sense to treat other people the way I believe that I'd like to be treated. And I figure that's about all we have a right to ask God to do for us. I mean, after all, if he was supposed to do everything, there'd be no reason to make us, would there? So I just kind of find out what's on the plate that's set in front of me and begin to eat it. Often as not, it's been a lot of crow. You got to be in a foul mood to live sometimes. I'll tell you, I never saw myself, though, as President of the United States. Never did. And I know, neither did you Republicans, and you still don't. I always just saw myself as Harry Truman. And I had the great misfortune to be in the right place at the wrong time. You know, around the White House here, they still call me His Accidency. Oh, yes, they do. I surprised the devil out of one of the cooks in the kitchen just a few weeks after I became president. It was May the 8th. You see, that's Victory in Europe Day. Also happens to be my birthday. And I was a very busy man that day, putting out communiques and all, and that kind of thing, and so was everybody else in the White House. And one of the cooks down there made me a birthday cake in the kitchen. And so I asked who it was, and they told me, and I went down to thank him. And when I walked through the door, they almost dropped the plates. And this fellow was very surprised when I walked up and thanked him for baking a birthday cake, and it was a very good one too, by the way. It had lemon. I love lemon. At any rate, I thanked him for it, and he said, "Why, Mr. President, I'm shocked." I said, "Why?" He said, "No president's been in this kitchen since Calvin Coolidge." And he only came in here to make sure we weren't handing the food out the back door to the poor. When I became president, I had to learn certain manners of behavior, you see. When you're president, you're supposed to act like a president. And some presidents haven't. But many times, if you just act like it, you'll get along all right. And rather than work, I'd rather just get along all right. Now, the most presidential-looking fella that was ever in the White House, they tell me, was Chester A. Arthur. Very distinguished gentleman. He was a bachelor president. He employed a prostitute on the premises of the White House. Down in Missouri, we call that a widower of means. I think the man that I admire the most, and it would be a different answer any day you ask me this, because there are lots of good presidents. But I think today, at least, the one that I admire the most is Thomas Jefferson. And I admire him because of his failing. You see, Thomas Jefferson despised slavery. When he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he tried very hard to get the Continental Congress to keep a clause in there that said slavery ought to be abolished in the new country. And of course, it was voted down, mainly by the delegates from the South. But Jefferson, when he became president, in his entire term, never did a single thing to end that institution of slavery. And in every day that he was in office, he regretted it. Teddy Roosevelt, of course, hadn't come along yet, but Teddy could have told him why. Teddy Roosevelt is a good Republican for you. Some of you ought to be taking notes on this. I'm quoting a Republican favorably. Teddy Roosevelt said, "Politics, meaning government, is the art of the possible." And for Thomas Jefferson to do something about slavery was not possible. So he suffered almost daily with terrible migraine headaches. And they stopped the day he left office. But I believe he was one of the greatest of men. He was a man who was willing to wrestle with himself. He was a man, therefore, who was willing to understand that he may not be all right, and that being President of the United States made him God of nothing. And that's one of the reasons I admire him so much. As I say, I never saw myself as president. I never tried to copy what other presidents would do. That's another thing my study of history told me. And there's no reason to worry too much about any decision that you make. Think about it, yes. But if you're worrying, you're not thinking. If you're worrying, you can't make a decision, you can only react. So you got to train yourself not to worry, but to think instead. So I don't compare myself to anybody else. There's never been a decision that I've ever made in my life that somebody didn't make before me. Even the use of the atomic bomb, the ultimate weapon. But I wasn't the first man ever to use the ultimate weapon. The first man ever to use the ultimate weapon was the first fellow who was duking it out with somebody, I suppose, who thought to pick up a stick. Or the first man to think of the idea of how to make an arrow. Or the first man to think of gunpowder. Or the first man to think of using horses in battle. Or the first man to think of using a shield. Every one of those inventions, you can absolutely guarantee it, folks were saying this will be the ruination of the world. And in every case, it's almost come to pass. So there's never a decision you're ever going to make in your life that's not been made before. None of us are that special. We're special, but not that special. That's always been a great comfort to me. Great comfort. I was going to tell you about Winston Churchill. I think I will. Winston Churchill is another fellow I never compare myself to. But, well, for example, here's why. Winston just is not the diplomat that I am. I mean, he offends people. But I'm sure you've all heard of the Lady Astor. She's from Virginia, you know, the great Lady Astor? She's from Virginia, born and raised there. And she moved over to England, and inside of 6 months, she had a British accent so thick, even the British couldn't understand her. Let alone stand it, you know. And now Winston and I had different ways of dealing with her. I ran into her one time at a ceremonial dinner of some kind down in Williamsburg, and she took exception to my Missouri accent. And she said to me, Mr. President, must you speak with that accent? Well, in my best diplomatic and presidential manner, I looked at her and I said, well, my lady, at least my accent's an honest one. Now, Winston did not know to handle people that well. He ran into the great lady at a dinner party in London one time, where they served large quantities of brandy, which is why Winston was there. He consumes large quantities of brandy and is able to do so single-handed if he's called upon. And he had done so that evening. The Lady Astor was seated right next to the Prime Minister, and in great indignation she said, Mr. Prime Minister, I believe you are quite drunk. And Winston looked at her and said, Lady Astor, you're quite right. I am quite drunk. And you are unbelievably ugly. But, said the Prime Minister, in the morning I shall be sober. She got back at him, though. She said, Mr. Prime Minister, if I were married to you, I would put poison in your brandy. And he said, Lady Astor, if I were married to you, I would drink it gladly. Well, I'll tell you. There was a time when someone in the White House, I don't remember who it was, asked me how I could laugh with all of the problems that we have faced in our administration. There was World War II, the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, crisis in Turkey and in Greece, the invasion of South Korea, on and on and on. And I've always told folks, if they asked me about that, that it would cause me to ask instead, how can you not laugh? You know, Abraham Lincoln was accused of being a baboon and a clown and such. And one day, it was after one of the major battles of the Civil War, he was out visiting the troops. And he got in an ambulance, which was really not an ambulance, it was a big wagon. And he's riding inside of it, you see. And he had just visited a field hospital where there was a pile of arms and legs hip high of the president outside the door of the tent. And he had gone in and tried to shake hands with a man who had to tell him that he couldn't raise a hand because the arm was gone. And he had visited Confederates who also had amputations. Terrible war, the Civil War, because they had come up with the ultimate weapon. It was rifling in the barrel of a gun, so that the bullet now, to use in the barbarity of war, could kill with accuracy at over 300 yards. And the tactics were still for 100 yards or less. 600,000 Americans died in the Civil War. That is more than the Revolution, the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, more than all of the other military engagements this nation has fought ever combined. And Abraham Lincoln, riding in this ambulance through the battlefield where there were still dead bodies and burial details, who had been crying a few moments before, was told a joke, and he laughed. And there was a strange critter known as a newspaper reporter who heard it and took him to task. And Lincoln said to his friends, were I not to laugh, my heart would break. Well, I've always liked a good story, and I intend to go on liking them. I hope you'll all take note that it has now been somewhere in the vicinity of 10 minutes I've spoken with you, and you haven't heard me say damn or hell once. Damn. Excuse me, ladies. It's not true that I swear a great deal. And I never swear in front of the ladies except when I slip. So my apologies in advance. It's also not true that I'm a bad poker player. It's not true that I'm a good poker player. I'm an average poker player. There are a lot of things that you'll hear about a president that aren't so, you know. Especially if his name is Harry Truman. I have seen myself depicted by people as some sort of a fiery, testy, shoot-from-the-hip kind of fella. And that's not so. My favorite hobby of all is reading. Still is. Always will be, I think. I like to think things through. It's been said that I don't make a decision until the last minute. Well, now, I don't know how you can shoot from the hip but not decide to the last minute, but I'll plead guilty to that one. Because what I believe in life is that you make a decision when you have to. See, there's no reason to make a decision in advance of the time that you have to. Because what if something else happens? What if you get some other little piece of information? On the other hand, if you've got 10 minutes to make a decision, you better make it in 9 minutes and 59 seconds. And if you turn out to be wrong, so what? You only had 9 minutes and 59 seconds, for heaven's sake. Give yourself a break, I always say. Been saying that a lot lately. I love Bess Truman. I met Bess Truman when I was a preschooler. My family just moved into town, into Independence, and my brother, Vivian, and I were walking down the street, and this minister introduced himself to us because we were strangers, and he asked us to come to his Sunday school, so I went. And sitting there in front of me, just a few people in front of me, was this absolute vision of a little girl with a long ponytail. And so I went up to her and I didn't pull it. But I fell in love with her then, and I said to myself that very day, and I know some folks think this is baloney, but it's not. I said, I'm going to marry her someday. Bess is very stubborn. It took a long time. I was past 30 before we had our first daughter. Well, I'll tell you, the reason was she was very accommodating to me. Through school, I'd ask her if I could carry her books home and that kind of thing, and she always let me do it. And then, but somehow or another, we just never really clicked, you see. It clicked for me when we got out of high school. I had a job for a short time working on a railroad to help them take care of the payroll and such. And then I decided that I wanted to be a rich man, or at least not poor. So I went to work in Kansas City in a bank. Bankers, there's a bunch of crooks for me. Yeah, well, if you want a friend in life, you get a dog, you know what I mean. But at any rate, I was working there and I was doing pretty well until my father out on the farm broke his leg. And they'd gone back up the farm, and so I had to leave the bank and go out and help to run the farm. And what that meant was that I could no longer, on occasion, see Bess on a Saturday night. I would go and I'd take her into Kansas City and we'd go and see the stage shows and the musicals, listen to the concerts and such. So I was reduced to writing letters to her. And gentlemen, if you want to take notes on this, it's all right, because I'm going to tell you how I won the heart of this woman. First thing I decided to do was invite her out to the farm. Now, Mother Wallace, that's Bess's mother. Mother Wallace was... Mother Wallace is a pistol, I'll tell you. Well, she's the woman who taught me the truth in the old saying that behind every successful man, there is a good wife and one hell of a surprise mother-in-law. What happened was is that Bess kept saying no. But you see, Bess was the best athlete in Independence, Missouri. She was a fine tennis player. And as a hitter, well, she was just, I think she had no peers in baseball. She could hit the heck out of that thing. So what would happen is her brothers would go to Mother Wallace when she was a teenager, and they'd say very properly, because Mother Wallace was a very proper woman, Mother, we would like to take our sister for a walk. So they would dress her up in a nice dress, and out they go. And when they got to the park, she'd roll that dress up and tie it off and step up to the plate. And she was one heck of a third baseman, too, let me tell you. But she made her mark in athletics, really, as a tennis player at school. And so when I got off the farm, she kept saying no, but she couldn't play tennis anymore because she wasn't in school anymore. So I decided I knew how to win her heart. I built a tennis court on the farm. I went out there and I plowed it and I dished it and I harrowed it and I flattened it. And I went into town and I bought me one of those roller things, you know, that you can pull behind the horses. Big drum. You fill it up with water and it flattens out the ground. And I bought one of those. Cost me $9.48. Well, she was worth it. It's a lot of money, but she's worth it. So I went and I built me that tennis court, and I planted grass, and I got it all growing up there, and I got some lime, and I put the lines on it, and I invited Bess to come out and play tennis on a weekend, and she said yes. She was coming out Saturday. Well, I'll tell you, I was just beside myself. I could hardly plow the furrows straight the whole darn week. It came to be Thursday, and I was excited, and Friday morning, I was even more excited, and Friday afternoon we got the worst rainstorm in the history of Jackson County, Missouri. The lime all washed away, and the tennis court turned to mud, and Bess didn't come. But I didn't give up. No, sir. It wasn't long after that she wrote me a letter in which she said that she wanted to raise a little extra spending money for herself. And she's going to do it by raising chickens. Well, I knew something about that, because my own mother raised chickens. And to raise healthy chickens, you got to dip them, you see, to make sure that they don't get ticks or something like that. I don't know what it is. But I got my mother to write down for me her recipe for chicken dip. And I wrote to Beth, Bess, and I said, now, Bess, you want to take proper care of them chickens, here's what you do. And I wrote the whole thing out there and then said after that, and said, and by the way, I sure would like it if you'd marry me. Well, for some reason, she turned me down. The next thing I knew, they up and started World War I. And by that time, Bess had allowed even to me that she is in love, too. But it didn't seem proper that we ought to get married with a fella going off to war. So I went off to war. And I wanted as quick as I could so I could get back to Bess. I fought in the Battle of Who Run, you know. I was a captain in the artillery, and we were over there in France. And we're on the line, not too long before the whole thing ended. And some of the boys got the ideas, a bunch of Irishmen from Kansas City, they're all in the same unit. They used to organize the army that way then. And these fellas were a bunch of Irish Catholics. And need I say more, you know. They'd like, I call it tip a blow for liberty. Well, they didn't strike blows for liberty. They tore down the whole bell. They drank a lot, those fellas, and they liked to fight, too. And well, I had to whip them into shape, so I had to be pretty tough. And I was very tough. And these guys were tough, but they got wind somehow that the Germans were going to attack them, and each one thought it was personal. And when the Germans did open up a little fire, these Irishmen started running. Every one of them started to run. Now, when you're a lowly captain, and I'm only 5'9", and I don't weigh 150 pounds soaking wet, you've only got one weapon. When a bunch of Irishmen, every one of whom is 7'300", starts running at you. First thing you do is get out of the way, and the second thing you do is swear like hell at them. And I did. I called them every name in the book, and I told them to get back to their guns, and they did. And we called that the Battle of Who Run. At any rate, when the war was all over, I got home, and a fellow named Eddie Jacobson, who had been a friend of mine in the Army, we had decided we were excellent businessmen. We had run a commissary unit for our unit, and the commissary went very well. You know, that's where you collect up some money to start with, and you sell pencils and papers and soda pops to the boys and that kind of thing. We did well by it. And so we went into the haberdashery business, opened up a men's store in Kansas City. And we were doing right well, too, till the Depression of 1922 hit. Some folks have called that a recession, but when you go broke, it's a depression. Anyway, we went broke in it, and both of us landed out in the street. But Eddie wound up on his feet, because he was one heck of a salesman. He could sell anything to anybody. And he went out and got a job selling shirts to people. And I was out of work. And a fellow named Pendergast, another fellow we had served with, came to see me and said he wanted me to meet his Uncle Mike, who was a brother to Tom Pendergast, who was a political leader in Kansas City. Those Republicans again? Now, you folks would call him a boss, but you see, when he's in your party, he's a leader. Well, at any rate, I met them, and they figured I ought to run for county judge. Now, that's not a judge like you think of things today. That's more like a, we'll say, a county commissioner might be in your state in Washington, at least. I assume most of them out there. Wonderful state, too. But anyway, so I went ahead and ran for it, and I won the election because I had more relatives than any other candidate in Jackson County. And that's how I got my start in politics. I was out of work, and I never got a political job I really wanted. I didn't really want to be a county judge, but I figured since it was put in front of me, I'd go ahead and do it. Later on, I wanted to be a United States congressman. And I went to Tom Pendergast, not that I had to ask his permission to run or anything like that, but I couldn't win without his support. And he said, no. They wanted me to be a United States senator. So I ran for the United States Senate. I didn't think I could do the job. I keep waiting for the Republicans to say you were right. But at any rate, I didn't. And I found out I loved the United States Senate, and I decided I wanted to stay there. And then Franklin Roosevelt made me run for vice president. And then you know what happened after that. I certainly didn't want to be president. But at any rate, you don't always do the things you want to do in life. I remember as county judge, Eddie Jacobson did a marvelous thing for me. I had been defeated for re-election and decided to run one more time later on, and I got re-elected. But that time I was defeated was because of the Ku Klux Klan. and you'll still hear rumors about me and the Ku Klux Klan. That I contributed money to them. Well, it's true, I did. The problem was I didn't know that they were the KKK. These fellas were upset with me because, as a county judge, I was one of three guys who had a policy in our county that said we might hire Catholics. And we might hire Jews. And we might even hire niggers. Well, they couldn't stand for that. Oh, no. So they came to me and they offered support in my bid for re-election. Just a group of fellows, and I said, fine. And they said that they had a little service club going, and would I mind giving them a donation? And I don't know, $5 or something, and I did. And they said that support was contingent upon us changing that policy. And they identified themselves as members of the KKK. Well, I told them they could take their support and put it where the sun didn't shine. And I eventually got my money back, too, by God. And they threatened to kill me, and I believed them. Now, by that time, we'd had little Margaret. And I was upset. I was very angry. Over in Lee's Summit, they're going to have a meeting on a Saturday. I found out about it. And I'll tell you, Eddie Jacobson did the most courageous thing I've ever seen a fellow do. He insisted on going with me. He would not let me out of his sight till I said he could go with me. And that was courageous because he was what they hated the most. He was himself a Jew. Good evening, boys. Howard, sit down. I've got something to say. Yes, I recognize you even in a sheet. I've got something to say to you, boys. I'll take the vote if any man wants to vote for me. But don't you vote for me if you think we would never hire a Catholic. Don't you vote for me if you think we'd never hire a Jew. Don't you vote for me if you think I'd never hire a nigger. Because your support's not worth that. Now, I understand some of you boys want to kill me. Here I am, right here. Come on! Tough bunch. You're only tough in a bunch. I just wanted to get it straight, boys. Now, Eddie and I are going to go down and strike a blow for liberty. But before I go, there's something I want to tell you. Something Eddie told me on the way up here. He told me on the way up here that the KKK was started by a Jew and he could prove it. Shut up, Howard, I will tell you. And he did prove it. Only a Jew could sell you idiots a $1.98 nightshirt for $16. Well, I lost that election. I was never so proud to lose anything in my life. Here I have rattled on and on about my early life. And I haven't even told you about the presidency. Well, actually, the most important things that happen in life are when you're young, don't you think? I mean, how could the Truman Doctrine compare in my memory to meeting Bess Truman in Sunday school? Well, I became president because Franklin Delano Roosevelt died. I became vice president because I was called to a hotel room in Chicago in the Democratic Convention in 1944. I had already said that I was going to nominate for Vice President Jimmy Burns because I'd been told Burns was Roosevelt's choice. And people kept asking me for 2 days if I was going to run, and it was mainly the railroad union boys. God love them. I sure do. They got me reelected to the Senate once, but at any rate, they won me for vice president for some reason, and at any rate, I kept saying no, and finally one of them says, you're going to come into this hotel room. And I go into the room, and one of the boys is talking to Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the telephone. I don't know if you've ever heard Roosevelt, but, well, when he's on a telephone, you could hear him clear back in that corner over there. See what I mean? And as I'm coming in there, he is saying, have you guys got that Missouri mule lined up yet? Well, I thought maybe I'd been set up.
but when it's the president. And this fellow said, no, we don't, because he's stubborn as a Missouri mule. And Roosevelt said, you tell Harry Truman, if he wants to be the downfall of the Democratic Party, that's his own damn business, and hung up the phone. So I ran for vice president of the United States. By the way, the trip home from Chicago down to Missouri was the coldest July ride I've ever experienced, because Bess did not want me to run for vice president of the United States. You ask my daughter Margaret about that, she'll tell you about it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt took the oath of office and left the country. Went to Yalta. He was out of the country for over 40 days of the 80-some days that I was vice president. I met with him about three times. And there I was presiding in the Senate one day, and there was a fellow named Alexander Wiley, Republican from Wisconsin, who was up talking about the water crisis in Colorado. Well, that's a Republican for you. And at any rate, I got bored and I decided to go to see the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Sam Rayburn, because Sam kept a drawer with a little turkey nip in it. And along about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was always invited in. And when I got there, they told me that I had to call the White House. And I called and they said I had to get over there right away. And something told me to run. That's all they said to me. I thought that the president had maybe come home because a friend of his had passed away. And maybe they wanted to talk about some important legislation or something. And I got there and Ms. Roosevelt met me at the door. And when they opened the door, she said, Harry, the president's dead. I felt like the sun and the moon and the stars had all fallen on me. I did not see myself as president of the United States. And I said to her, I said, oh my God, Ms. Roosevelt, is there anything I can do for you? And then's when it really hit me. Because that great lady took my hand and said, no, Harry, is there anything we can do for you? You're the one in trouble now. Well, I asked that Bess and Margaret be called, and when they got there, they searched around the White House. They were able to find a Bible in the Roosevelt White House, for those who are wondering. And I put my hand on it, and I became the President of the United States. And life hasn't been the same since. Before I left the room, there were presidential aides coming up to me and saying, we have a decision that must be made now, tonight. Do we go ahead with a conference in San Francisco to create this thing called the United Nations? And I looked around and there was no president to ask. So I said, yes. And before I could leave the room, Secretary of War Stimson, a man who had all manner of experience in foreign affairs, dating clear back to 1905, had served in several administrations, came to me and said, Mr. President, I must speak to you, and told me about a weapon that could be used that might even end the war. I only had a very few minutes. We lived on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. And we had wonderful neighbors. Just a couple about our age, in their 60s, early 60s. Wonderful neighbors. And I went home that evening. I knew that I had to go to sleep. Now, people have asked me, because I went to sleep at 9 o'clock that night, and I had no trouble sleeping, and people have asked me how it was that I could do that. Well, as I said before, you have to do what's in front of you. I had the worst job in the world to do. And you folks were the bosses, and you deserved the best I had. So, of course, I went to bed and went to sleep. But at any rate, when I got home, the neighbors had fixed me a chicken sandwich and a glass of milk. We went to work. As long as I mentioned the bomb, let's talk about the bomb. I never lost a minute of sleep over that decision. Never have, never will. I have yet to hear one word of apology from anyone for Pearl Harbor. Never have, never will. I have already heard, even before leaving office, criticism for dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I can tell you that there were people in the government, responsible scientists, who were opposed to dropping the bomb. I never was. History had taught me that when the ultimate weapon is developed, it is used. History had also taught me that no one ever invented anything that wasn't also invented by somebody else. I have heard people say we should have dropped a demonstration bomb. Well, they said that after they found out the bomb worked. You see, in all of our testing, we could never put the bomb in an airplane, fly it at altitude, drop it, and see if it worked. That would let the secret out. What we knew we could do was create an atomic explosion. We knew we could load something heavy on an airplane. We knew we could navigate the airplane. We knew we could drop bombs from the airplane. But could we do it all together? We didn't know. Now imagine what would have happened if we had called this demonstration, if one can assume that the Japanese would have so kindly said, fine, we'll come and watch your demonstration. Out there in the middle of the ocean somewhere, okay? Well, that's just ridiculous. But if we could have done it and the thing just went kerploosh, well, it's silliness. Yeah. Oh, and I've also heard that the Japanese were going to surrender. Well, it's true, we had broken their codes. I'm sure you've all heard that. And they were talking to several Scandinavian countries, the Swedes among them. And they were saying that they wanted those countries to talk to the Russians, to talk to us about maybe surrendering. Not unconditionally. I didn't believe them. These were the same folks who had been in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, December the 7th of 1941, in a meeting with American officials while the bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor. I didn't believe them, and neither did anybody else. We as a nation had made a commitment to unconditional surrender, which we eventually did pull away from just slightly anyway, by allowing the emperor to keep his title, although not his control, when the Japanese did surrender. So, if they were going to surrender, why didn't they? Why didn't they? They didn't surrender. Instead, they fought as hammer and tong on Okinawa. 30-some thousand American casualties taking the island of Okinawa. An island we needed as a staging area for a potential invasion of Japan. In 30 days, 30-some thousand American lives lost. 150,000 Japanese died on Okinawa. And 150,000 Okinawan civilians died on Okinawa. More than half of all the Americans who died in the Civil War. 30 days on Okinawa. The Japanese were going to surrender. The battle started with kamikaze pilots, young men who had been trained just enough about flying an airplane to point it at a target, and who willingly flew with only enough fuel to get to that target and killed themselves. And this was a nation that was going to surrender, huh? How How are we to believe that? How are we to believe that? We had been bombing Tokyo. We bombed Tokyo with firebombs. Twice in Germany, the British bombed Dresden with firebombs. Once we did. 130-some thousand people died at Dresden. And the firebombing of Tokyo in one night. Over 100,000 Japanese died. And we did it again. And we did it again. And again. And they didn't quit. And we bombed then other cities. Kyoto, Yokohama. And they never surrendered. The atomic bomb was dropped to end the killing. Oppenheimer, our chief scientist on that project, told me that 20,000 Japanese would be killed, in his estimation, by the first bomb. This was the chief scientist, the fellow in charge. Now, there were others who thought it would be more. Some said 30. Some said as many as 50,000. And of course, when the bomb dropped, 80,000 died right away. And inside of a matter of months, as many as 130,000, we'll never know for sure. But if you want to play that game of casualties, total all of that up. Do it again at Nagasaki. And tell me that you would choose to fight for another year and a half, which is what General George C. Marshall told me would happen if we invaded Japan. And you have probably heard that I created this figure that we have used that says 500,000 Americans would have died. Well, that's bunk. I did not create that figure in defense of my actions. You check a memo of June the 4th, in 1944, that was written to George C. Marshall by members of his staff, and you will find that they estimated American casualties in a Japanese invasion at between 500,000 and 1,000,000 lives. At least that meant many Japanese dead too. You know, it's very easy once a decision is made to see how simple it was. And for me, it was not a difficult decision. It was a difficult thing to do. And there is a difference. William Tecumseh Sherman said of war, "War is hell." And then that Yehu Patton came along in World War II and said, "Sherman said war is hell. By God, I'm going to prove it." But Sherman was right. And he did not relish war. I've studied his history. Prior to saying war is hell, General Sherman was in the South as the head of what later became Louisiana State University, as a matter of fact, begging the people of the South not to secede and start a war, explaining to them that with modern weaponry of the 1860s, war would be more terrible than anything any man had ever conceived of, and it was. And he explained it to them, and he begged them not to do it. And they did it. And then Sherman and Grant said the best way to stop this madness is to be better at it than they are. And that, my friends, is war. War is not a moral thing. War is not a pretty thing. War is not an idealistic thing. War is something that once it's begun, must be stopped. If you don't stop it, it will be fought and fought and fought. caves, on streets, in villages. And the casualties will mount and mount and mount, and the human race will fall. We dropped the bomb on Hiroshima in an attempt to end the war. We did not believe that it would by itself end it. We continued with our plans to invade Japan. Our hope was that it would end it, but our belief was that the use of nuclear weaponry might make our invasion less costly. Oh, and let me ask you one other thing. The Japanese were going to surrender, huh? And why didn't they after we dropped the first bomb? Why, on the day that Nagasaki was bombed, was there a meeting of the Japanese military leadership in which at least half, if not a majority, were saying to the emperor, fight on, they don't have the stomach to succeed in invading us. We can beat them. So we dropped the second bomb. And the Japanese surrendered. Well, now. I wish I could tell you that that puts me in mind of a story, but it doesn't. That was a very serious decision that we made, and one for which, again, I do not apologize. I have to be careful, though, about getting too excited. Wally Graham has told me that. He's my doctor, you know. I'll tell you, you get to be president of the United States, and I can guarantee you one thing, every physician in the country wants to work in the White House. I was amazed. Our phone was ringing off the hook, so I offered the job to a fellow who didn't want it, my personal physician, Wally Graham. He said no. People find it easy to say no when your name is Truman. And at any rate, he said no, and then I offered to make him in charge of Walter Reed Army Hospital. And he finally took the job. And he almost quit. He said there was just too much public pressure. For instance, it got out one day that I was not feeling well. And I wasn't. And a fellow named Chevalier Jackson from Temple University down in Philadelphia called up Wally. And Wally couldn't get him off the phone. He came in and said, Mr. President, please take this call yourself. I can't get rid of this fellow. I said, what's he want? He says, well, he thinks he can cure you. So I picked up the phone. Hello, Dr. Jackson, this is Harry Truman. Well, I am able to sit up and take nourishment. What's that you've got now? You want to give me a bronchoscopy? What's that? That's a long tube, huh? You put a light on the end of it? You stick it where? All right. Oh, down that. Well, fine. Well, fine, doctor. I'll tell you, you can come up right away and give me one of your bronchoscopies. But you will have to point it in the other direction. I say the other direction, because what I got's diarrhea. Hello, Dr. Jackson. I never heard from Chevalier Jackson ever again. That's not good. Oh, one other thing I wanted to tell you very quickly. I did not fire Douglas MacArthur because he was a stupid son of a bitch. Excuse me, ladies. He was. I fired him, though not for stupidity. I fired him because he violated the direct order of the President of the United States. You see, when the Russians got into World War II against Japan, they were trying to kick the Japanese out of Manchuria and so on. They were in there for just a short time. But when the war ended, for the matter of ease, just convenience, we told the Japanese in the Korean Peninsula to surrender to the Russians if they were north of the 38th parallel and to the Americans if they were south of it. And the next thing I knew, Joe Stalin had that being a whole country. And a couple of years later, just a few years later, in June of 1950, the North Koreans invaded South Korea. And they were making short order work of that country. And we made the decision right away to get in there. And we were very fortunate. We wanted to make it a United Nations police action. That's what it was. To enforce an international agreement. That's what we did. But MacArthur, in the course of that war, a long series of stories there, but I've taken up so much of your time already. In the course of that war, he did what General George McClellan used to do to Lincoln in the American Civil War. He issued communiques to the press, talking not about what had been done, but about what ought to be done by the president. McClellan even wrote to Lincoln and told him how to deal with England, for heaven's sake. Well, MacArthur wasn't writing to the president. He was telling the press all about it. And I flew out to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, Wake Island, and I set him straight on that and said, don't ever do that again. He said he wouldn't. I asked him if the Chinese were ever going to get involved in that war, in his opinion. He said, no, sir, because we'd lick them. A few months later, the Chinese got involved by the hundreds of thousands. And they whipped our boys badly. We finally got things turned around, though. And we got back up the peninsula, roughly to where the 38th parallel was. And we got very delicate negotiations going on. And I'll be darned if MacArthur doesn't write a letter to Joe Martin, Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, in which he said that if he had been allowed to prosecute the war, which was a police action, as he wanted to, we could win it, and we could lick Japan too. And that since the president wouldn't allow him to do that, that was tantamount to treasonous activity by the president of the United States. I fired him. You expect me to be the boss. I had told that man he did not have an argument with Harry Truman. He had an argument with the presidency of the United States. And I'll never regret that decision either. Oh, and as long as we're at it, Paul Hume, music critic for the Washington Post, is a fellow you should never read. I have what I call my spasms. That is to say that I'll sometimes get a little bit upset with somebody and I'll write them a letter. My press secretary for many years, Charlie Ross, who was a high school graduate along with me, and the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, by the way, for journalism, he took care of that because I would put my spasms in the out box and he would put them in the waste boxes. Unfortunately for me, Charlie Ross died, keeled over of a heart attack at the desk. Late in the afternoon of the very night that my daughter Margaret, who's a wonderful singer, she has been on the radio nationally. She has received some good reviews and some reviews that said she was not good, but never anything as mean as him wrote. At any rate, she had her first concert in Washington, D.C. to sing that night. And Charlie Ross had died, and Margaret and Charlie were very close, a lifelong friend of the families. I couldn't bear to tell her that night. So I went to the concert, and I normally would have wanted to, but didn't want to go. I came into my office the next morning knowing, one, I had to tell Margaret about Charlie Ross first thing when she woke up. And two, that we had communiques from Korea saying the Chinese had come into the war. I was not having a good day. And then I read Mr. Hume's review. He said, while she appeared to be a pleasing person, she did not have the voice that could carry the tone of the music. Well, what is all that? He didn't even like, he even criticized the pianist, for heaven's sake. Poor fellow just volunteering. So I sat down, I had me a spasm. Mr. Paul Hume, music critic, Washington Post, Washington, D.C., Mr. Hume. I have just read with great interest your review of my daughter Margaret's concert last night. And I have come to the conclusion that you are an 8-ulcer man on 4-ulcer pay. And half of those ulcers are working double overtime. I went on and on. Mr. Hume, I do not know you, but when we meet, you will need a beef steak for black eyes and a jock strap down below. And I signed it, God's humble servant, Harry Truman. And I put it in my coat. And I thought to myself, sorry you're not here, Charlie. And glad you're not. And I walked out past my secretary and I said, I'm going for a walk. And before anybody could catch me, I went for my walk and I got to a mailbox and I posted that. And I got pasted for it in the papers. But I sure enjoyed it. I'll tell you, Now, you have been very patient in listening to me, and I have gone on and on. So I thought that it would be appropriate this evening for me to say to you, if there's anything that you'd like to ask me, I'll be happy to dodge your questions. Did I have a slip of the tongue again? I meant answer them to the best of my ability. Any question at all you'd like to ask, so long as it's one that I can answer on. Yes?
Mr. President, was Japan working on a bomb as well?
Well, I don't believe that Japan was working on a bomb. There were people all over the world who were working on a bomb. Now, that is to say that there were people in science all over the world who were trying to discover the secrets of the atom. But a serious effort, I don't believe so. Other questions?
Mr. President.
Yes?
What did you think about Thomas Dewey?
I particularly appreciated his campaign for the presidency against me. Tom Dewey had been an effective attorney in New York. He had run against FDR once and came closer than anybody else had to beating him, so the Republicans thought that they had it in the bag. And that was Tom Dewey's problem. He thought he had it in the bag when he ran against me in 1948. So did everyone, by the way, in the press. But Tom Dewey was, he reminds me of, well, I often said he ought to shave that Hitler mustache. I thought it was the silliest thing for him to have a mustache look just like Hitler. And, but at any rate, I didn't tell him that. I wanted him to wear it, you know. But he would say such important things in his speech, because you see, he did something that you ought not to do in life. He took action based on fear of failure. He said, I've got it locked up. Let's not mess it up. And so he would make speeches that said, and I quote, my fellow Americans, the future of America yet lies before us. Well, I never saw any reason to disagree with it. And the pollsters kept saying that I was going to lose that election, you know. In fact, Clark Clifford was on my campaign train with me as an aide of mine. And we knew that Newsweek magazine had come out with a story the week before, and they said, next week, we're going to poll the 50 greatest political reporters in America about who's going to win the election. And so the morning that was supposed to come out, Clark snuck off that train, goes into the depot, not realizing I'm awake yet, you see. He gets a copy of the magazine, he comes back on, he's got it stuffed in his coat, and I said, where are you going, Clark, with that? He said, with what? I said, that magazine. Well, he looked at it. He pulled it out very sheepishly, and I said, what's it say, Clark? And he said, well, Mr. President, basically, it says, all 50 say Dewey's going to win. I said, don't you worry, Clark. I know all 50. And none of them got brains enough to pound sand in a water bowl. And we went on the campaign, you know the outcome. That night, on election night, I went to bed very early. And one of my young aides came in and woke me up in the middle of the night and said, Mr. President, you've been reelected. And I said, wake me up when there's something I don't know that you could tell me. And here's how I knew it. There was a reporter who was, by his own admission, the greatest reporter in the world. It was H.V. Keltenborn, radio reporter. And I've been listening to Mr. Keltenborn because, well, as you all know, when folks are talking on the radio, you should just take it as gospel. And so I listened to him when we were ahead. And he said, well, the president is ahead in the early returns. We're quite convinced when the great masses of rural America are heard from, Governor Dewey will win by an overwhelming margin of victory. And I thought, well, hell, if that's what he thinks, I'm in. Now, he was also a consultant. That's a word you better watch out for in your life, let me tell you. He was a consultant. And he was a consultant to the newspaper, the one in the world I know of that says on its masthead, it is the world's greatest newspaper, the Chicago Tribune. He was, by the way, that was the only client that Keltenborn had. And the Chicago Tribune called him up and said, are you sure it looks to us like Mr. Truman might win? And he said, I'm sure. So they ran with that headline, Dewey defeats Truman. That's my favorite picture. And I'm sorry I rattled on so long, but I'm so glad you asked that question, because I love to talk about Tom Dewey. My other questions. Yes.
Mr. President, I've often wondered why did Roosevelt feel like you were the really important one to have as vice president?
You've wondered that too?
Yes.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. That's a question that I must confess I've thought of on several occasions, although I don't let that kind of thing bother me very much. I would have liked to have talked to him the day he died, though, and asked him to put it off for a while. But no, I don't like to, I just don't like to visit. Things I can't do anything about. But I can't honestly tell you that, because you see, I had opposed Franklin Delano Roosevelt on a very major issue when I was a U.S. Senator, and he refused to support my bid for re-election. That's why I had one of the closest races in my life, trying to get reelected. Because at the time, I believed that two terms were enough for any man to be president. And I agreed with the Republicans that there ought to be a limitation on the terms. And I'm not so sure about that now. Well, no, I'm serious about that. I'm not so sure. Well, besides, that has to do with the presidency. This term limitation thing, let me tell you something about that. How would you feel if someone came up to you and said, for your own good, I would like to have you volunteer to give up one of your rights? Well, if you're a smart American, you'd say no. Term limits tell you can vote for anybody except never give away your rights. Never give them away. Make them fight you for them anyway. So to answer your question, I've got no answer. Other questions, though?
Yes, question?
How about clear everything with Sidney?
The man you're talking about was a labor leader. Now, not a boss, because he supported Democrat. He was a labor leader, and he was in the railroads. And it is alleged that the word among Roosevelt's aides was that FDR had said, clear everything with Sidney when selecting a vice president. Well, I honestly don't know about that. I would seriously doubt, though, that Franklin Roosevelt said anything like that, meaning that labor ought to pick the candidate. But Franklin Roosevelt, my heavens, was a smart politician, and in this country, if you're a Democrat and you want to get elected, you're going to have the support of labor. So I would assume that there was a list of names that went through Sidney and the other labor boys. And if I was on it, then they approved it, so much the better. Other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
The contradiction between your commitment to the golden rule, doing unto others as you would wish them to do unto you, and the decision to bomb hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians in Japan is patently grotesque. However, what I want to know, the question I want to ask is that U.S. command also knew that there were United States prisoners of war in both Europe and North Africa, and the decision was made to bomb anyway, despite that knowledge. How do you square that?
Sir? What was patently grotesque was the decision by the Japanese to bomb Pearl Harbor. Innocent civilians. Yeah, you asked the question, sir. I would appreciate it if you'd let me answer it.
Knowing that there's 2,000...
I would appreciate it, sir, if you'd let me answer it.
Okay, go ahead. If
I can respond. Innocent civilians. You know, there's a strange thing about civilians and war. How many mothers of American soldiers were innocent civilians? How many fathers? How many children? What American did not realize in the course of the war that he was fighting the war? When was there a day in the war when the American government didn't tell the American people, you're part of the war? No man. None. Can look inside of Harry Truman or any other president who's ever made such a decision and say that they cared not for what happened. I said before, and I will say it again, the decision was not difficult. It was a difficult thing to do. And there were American prisoners of war kept in virtually every area that might be a target. And one of the reasons that we decided, by the way, not to tell the Japanese where we were going to drop a test bomb was our fear that they would indeed move American prisoners of war by the thousands to that site. Now, did you have something else, sir?
Yeah, what about the Golden Rule?
The Golden Rule. Well, I'll tell you. What do I do about the Golden Rule when you take a gun and shoot me? I am not Jesus Christ, but I can't tell you for sure even what he'd have done. See, the Golden Rule, do unto others, is a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, in our world, it is still a goal. And my apologies at a temper, but I do have one. And I want the people of America to know, although I'd never go out and tell them in any broad sense, because I'm just not built that way, that no one felt that burden nearly as heavily as me. And I think it has already gotten out through one of those things they call leaks in the White House. And after the second bomb had been dropped, I said, be sure we don't drop a third one without my order. I don't want to kill any more kids. Any other questions? Yes?
What day did you die?
Do you know something I don't? That's a reasonable question. That's a reasonable question. I'm not clairvoyant, but if I were, I might say try sometime in 73. But that's far enough away, I feel all right saying that. But you know, I have seen evidence of dead presidents walking around in the White House. Teddy Roosevelt claimed to talk to Abraham Lincoln. Well, they're Republicans, it makes sense. And I personally, one night, was sitting alone, and I heard the drapes rustle, and the door to my room opened and closed again, and I thought it was probably James Buchanan and James Pierce arguing about which one of them screwed up this country the worst as president. But the night wasn't over, because Millard K. Fillmore came into the room and started to put in his 2 cents worth, and it was a din so bad I had to leave. Any other questions? Well, I'll tell you, I deeply appreciate your questions. I appreciate all of them, by the way. I'd like to leave you with 2 thoughts. One, be partisan. Be partisan. There's nothing wrong with partisan politics. This country's built on it. I'm a Democrat, and I'm damn proud of it. And if you're a Republican, I'm damn proud of you for choosing up sides. And if you're nothing, well, just think about that for a minute. You see, it's perfectly all right to choose up sides. And if something's wrong, fix it and be a part of fixing it. It's perfectly all right to argue like the Dickens. As long as you recognize that that argument is over things and ideas, and it's the argument and the chewing on it that makes things grow. And as long as you never get personal about it. I'm about to leave the office of President of the United States. And I'm glad to do it, I must tell you. I decided in April of 1949 that I was not going to run again for president. Because I thought by 1952 that would be enough time for me. Now the amendments passed, you know, but they grandfathered me in there. Even some Republicans voted to do that. I think they were hoping they'd have me to beat. But I decided not to. Because Benjamin Franklin said once that in a free society, the sovereign, or president, is not the man in charge. He is the servant hired by the boss, and the boss is the people. All right. Then I'm leaving. And I thank you for the promotion, because now I'll get to be one of the bosses. Good night.
Thank you.